Blog Talk Radio.
We'd like to welcome everyone to a special edition of Africa on the Move. This is a special edition in which we're going to be discussing African Liberation Day 2014 and African Unity. Before we go into discussion, let's do a little bit cleaning out in terms of processes that we can use tonight. For those who may not be familiar with this particular program, we first and foremost will entertain the major focus of this program, which will be centered around African Liberation Day, for the first 45 to 50 minutes. After that time, we will open up our phone line to our listening audience. They may call in at 323-679-0841. When you call in, if you would like to be recognized to have a question or make a statement, please make sure you hit number one on your button so we can recognize the last four numbers of your phone call. Next, once we open our lines for discussions, we are going to request for all of our callers or call in, can you please keep your question or your comment down to a minute? And we thank you very much. So on that note, tonight, Africa on the Move is part of the International Pan-African Movement. This program is geared toward to represent and serve underserved communities and to speak truth to power. And we often deal with ideas and topics that are very germane to the survival and the interests of our people and humanity. And tonight, we have a great institution coming up called African Liberation Day. And with that discussion, we'd like to have one of our panelists tonight, Anthony Williams, who is an organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC, to give us a historical background of how AID came into existence. Welcome, Brother Anthony.
Our revolutionary greetings, Brother Africa, and fellow guests of this program. Thanks for having me. African Liberation Day started 58 years ago as African Freedom Day, which was originally held on April 15th. And it started in Accra, Ghana, by Kwame Nkrumah and the Convention People's Party to mark the ongoing progress of the attainment of freedom by Africans on the continent and in the diaspora. This is the 58th anniversary of African Liberation Day, and at the close of the founding conference of the Organization for African Unity in 1963, at the close, which was May 25th, African Freedom Day was moved to May 25th and changed to African Liberation Day. African Liberation Day has been commemorated in several countries, internationally in several countries around the world. Not just in Africa, but also in various parts of the diaspora, particularly in the socialist countries of Eastern Europe and Cuba. And let's see, this year's theme is Smash the Neocolonialist Intelligentsia, the True Face of the Counter-Revolution. And we chose this theme because today neocolonialism is the primary method by which imperialism is manifesting itself against African people worldwide.
Okay, Brother Anthony, what are some of the political aims and objectives historically of this institution? What role does it really seek to play in terms of the ongoing movement of the liberation and unification of Africa and African people?
Let's see. The historical purpose of African Liberation Day, in addition to marking the accomplishments, setbacks, and achievements of the struggle for African Liberation Day, it is also serves as a mechanism for galvanizing and organizing our people to achieve Pan-Africanism, the total liberation and unification of Africa under scientific socialism. And it is an institution that seeks to advance the organization of the masses of our people. Let's see, African Liberation Day has suffered several achievements and setbacks over its 58-year history, just as the movement for Pan-Africanism has suffered and setbacks and made various accomplishments over the years. And one being the issue of identity and the necessity of socialism as a condition for the unification of Africa.
Okay. I've been speaking with Brother Anthony Williams, who is an organizer for the African People Revolutionary Party, GC. He had just given us a historical reference of the history of the African Liberation Day and some of its goals and objectives. We'll be coming back to Anthony as we continue to talk about African Liberation Day as an institution and its relationship to our people's survival and the unification and liberation of our home, Africa. Our next panel tonight, we have the Brother Paul Pumphrey. He is from the Friends of the Congo, and we'd like to welcome him to Africa on the Move, and we'd like to ask him to introduce himself and tell us a little bit of what kind of work that he is doing as relates to the overall interests of Africa's survival and liberation. Brother Paul, welcome to Africa on the Move. Can you give people a brief background, who you are, and something about your organization? What are you doing to help liberate our brothers and sisters at home and abroad?
Thank you. My name, first of all, in the year of 2004, three Africans, myself, Maurice Pani, and Terry Crawford, were looking at the situation happening in the Congo and saw it as one of the biggest contradictions working against the people of African descent in the continent itself. For those who are not aware, there was a war that was started in the Congo in 1996 and then escalated in 1998, and to date has killed over 6 million people. And that war was a war really around resources. It was a war that was orchestrated by the United States and Europe using the armies of Uganda and Rwanda that has been heavily documented by the United Nations and many other international organizations. And interestingly enough, the only area of the Congo in which this war has taken place is in the eastern part of the Congo, where about $24 trillion worth of minerals happen to be in the ground. This war has taken place, for the most part, nowhere else inside of the Congo. In the very beginning, in 1996, the war moved in and removed Mobutu out of power. But as far as the lasting war itself, it has been concentrated in the eastern part of the Congo. And this is the reason why we define it as a resource war, a war that's been financed, has had U.S. military advisors, U.S. military trainers training the forces that has carried out this vicious war against the people of the Congo. And it's quite clear that the only reason that these forces are carrying out this war is to get their hands on the resources in the ground. And, of course, the countries that have been involved, as I named, Rwanda and Uganda, and for a short while, Burundi, these countries have no real capabilities of processing any of these minerals that are coming out of the ground in the Congo. And so they basically are playing the role of securing these minerals and selling them on the international market to different European, U.S., and Chinese companies. One of the minerals that they have really focused on is a mineral called coltan. And coltan is essential for sophisticated electronics. So some of us, if you remember back 25 years ago, 20 years ago, when we had cell phones, most of the cell phones were as big as a small box because they had to have a fan in those cell phones to keep the electronic components cool enough so that they could function. Coltan was the substance that allowed for the miniaturizing of the cell phone and many other electronic devices because it holds the electric charge for a long while as well as it does not generate the heat that other electronic components usually generate when functioning as the old cell phone used to be. We most of us know when you look at a desktop computer has a fan on it to cool off the components. But the laptop does not need as large a fan, neither does the different pads that people are using today as electronic components to do some of the electronic work, and that is because of coltan. And so the companies that are using this coltan certainly aren't companies inside of Africa. So this war has been carried out to benefit multinational corporations in Europe, Asia, North America for the most part. And recognizing this, we decided it was important that we begin to make people and help people in the United States become more aware of the role that these U.S. companies are playing, as well as the U.S. government is playing, in carrying out genocide against the people of the Congo. Now, prior to my work with Friends of the Congo, back in the 70s, I was, in fact, 1975, I was a co-founder of the Anti-Apartheid Movement USA. And we, again, took advantage of doing an educational campaign here in the United States about what was happening in Southern Africa, in the countries of Zimbabwe, South Africa, Namibia. At the same time, we also talked about what was going on in Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau, and Angola, because their struggle also was connected to the Portuguese colonialization in Africa, in which the Portuguese, which was considered one of the poorest countries in Europe, was getting a lot of its weapons and technical assistance from NATO, which was led by the United States. Again, another way in which these countries that were very rich in minerals were being super exploited with the help of U.S. tax dollars and U.S. military hardware. So those are two of the things, two of the movements that I have worked with, as well as I have supported African Liberation Day for a number of years, as I'm based in Washington, D.C., and many of the rallies have taken place here in Washington, D.C., on May 26th. So I'll stop at this point and wait to do more conversation later. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. We next go to our next panelist. Our next panelist is Alberta Jones. Alberta Jones, he's an organizer for the Caribbean American Children Foundation. Alberta Jones, can you talk a little bit about your organization and how does your work fit in the schemes of this whole Pan-African movement in terms of trying to seek the liberation of our people?
Yes, good evening. My name again is Alberto Jones, Cuban origin. I've been in the United States since 1980. One of the things that we try to do through the Caribbean American Children Foundation is bring together in as much as we can both a group of people of African descent living in the United States, the Caribbean, and those living in Cuba. Primarily, this is done in order to take advantage, to become part of the educational, health, and other areas of development that exist in Cuba and is not well known outside of the country, especially in the United States. The problem the brother described in the Congo happens, unfortunately or tragically, throughout the entire continent and in the Caribbean. We continue to be the victim of all of these transnational. I believe that we are taking advantage of, primarily because of our low level of education, our lack of a network, our poor interaction, and seeing the thousands of students from Africa in Cuba have led me to believe that that could be a unifying point. The largest amount of people with higher education that we are able to develop is maybe the fastest way of being able to stand up to these abuses. Coincidentally, in addition to the education, health, and other type of development support that many African and many Caribbean countries and Asian countries have received in Cuba, today there is also the possibility of participating in the development, the economical development that is taking place there. We need to be aware of it so that people of African descent are not let out of this opening. We can hear and see lots of activities that are taking place in the United States, primarily among Cuban migrants or emigre of Hispanic descent. We did not have anything before, and we cannot afford, once again, now that there are an opening in the private industry or the private commerce, to be left out. Thank you.
Okay, and we'll go next. Our next panelist. Our next panelist is our brother Haki Kumafi Muchoki. He's an organizer for the African Awareness Association. He can tell us a little something, a brief background in terms of who he is, and also we'd like for him to speak about his experiences of going home and how do he view the importance of this institution that we call African Liberation Day in terms of playing a role of trying to unite our people. So, Brother Haki, can you give us just a perspective in general, a little bit about you, and based upon your experiences of going home, you've been going for many years, how do you see this whole role or this institution, African Liberation Day, how do you see this institution playing a role to help move our people forward from your perspective, from your experiences?
Yes. His name is Haki. I've been doing this for over 30 years in terms of community organizing. And you know, I started out many years ago in an organization called the East, and then I got there and went to an organization called African Students Awareness. Previously, I've been a part of the AAPRP and as well as the Republic of New Africa. So I've dedicated my life over 30 years in terms of the fulfillment of toward the aspirations of our African people, not only African people as relate to African people in America, but African people throughout the diaspora. I think historically, when we talk about the level of injustice that it African people, there's no question that the intensity and the level of aggression directed toward African people is at atrocious levels. So clearly, there has to be some type of redress in terms of dealing with a system that's clearly antagonistic to the aspirations and or longevity of African people on this planet. So having said that, to answer your question, you know, you're right. I go to Africa every year, and one of the things that's very, very striking, I think, is that when I talk to a lot of brothers and sisters, you know, back on the continent, one thing is very, very apparent. This whole issue in terms of class is quite profound, you know, in Africa. Now, one of the things that when you talk about, you know, think about change, there has to be some type of coalition, some type of discussion, some type of discourse that, in fact, deals with the question in terms of one's oppression. One of the real stumbling blocks in terms of, you know, African people moving forward and, you know, in terms of their fight against imperialism is that a lot of African leaders, for whatever reason, have taken a position that talking to other African leaders is tantamount to a waste of time. And so it's clear they simply don't do it. They're much more interested in terms of having discourse with Western countries. And I'm hard pressed to even understand, you know, that philosophy. I know to some extent it's a legacy of colonialism, you know, in Africa. And certainly it's a function of current neocolonialism as it exists in Africa. So I do historically understand in terms of, you know, somewhat why that dynamic exists. But in terms of the fundamental question in terms of the aspirations, you know, of Africa's people, to capitulate to the West, knowing full well that there's never have been any tangible benefits in terms of, you know, going along with whatever the West wants, then the African leaders persist in doing so. So it's a very troubling kind of paradox that exists. Now, the question in terms of class, I think one reason why the AARP is so instrumental in terms of trying to bring about, you know, the end of imperialism, creating a situation, a system which is, you know, ensures, you know, the right and the concerns of African people are addressed. I think the AARP will be very good in terms of it's serving as some kind of conduit in which, you know, they exist. And so not being on the continent, they have some type of, a lot of members are on the continent. But what I'm saying is outside the continent, I think because you got this strong, you know, tribal instinct among a lot of African leadership, I think that if we're going to break down those barriers, I think it's going to probably come from Africans outside of Africa in terms of being, in terms of mediating, you know, what we see as the problem, you know, worldwide. I think for whatever reason, the class and or tribalism sort of mitigates against African people actually talking to them to judge in terms of the eradication of imperialism. So I think the AAPRP is critical in terms of bringing that discussion to the continent, you know, as AAPRP has been doing, but to continue to bring that discussion, you know, to the continent in terms of to bring clarity, you know, to get them to deal with the question in terms of class, in terms of, you know, its destructiveness to the aspirations of African people, you know, not only in the continent but throughout the world. But no question about that, AAPRP will be very, very instrumental in terms of that whole process. I recently got back from South Africa, and one of the things which is so disconcerting is that, you know, a lot of the, you know, when you go there, when you go to the Bantustans, so-called Bantustans, or these slums, when they talk about the land being arid, it's not an understatement. It's very, very real. I mean, the land is so worthless. I mean, the only thing you can, there's nothing you can do on the land at all. So you got millions and millions of people congregated or put in a position in which there's no possible way in terms of them, grow food. No possible. I mean, even water. I mean, it's you have one fountain in which people go to get their water. So it's sort of pretentious. It's sort of when you think about it, the inhumanity of it all. And when you look at what's happening in South Africa in terms of no real redress in terms of ANC, just one pause to think that that in fact imperialist forces are winning. But thankfully, one thing I can credit Nelson Mandela with doing is that when he talked about the fact that, listen, when he told the people, listen, if ANC doesn't do what it's supposed to do, then therefore, you know what you got to do. And I'm also equally pleased with the fact that you got the PAC, who have continued to organize the mass of the folk in South Africa, to serve as some kind of counterweight in terms of, sort of critiquing, ANC in terms of its unfulfilled mission in terms of resolving the problems that the African people face, particularly the question around land. I talked to some political prisoners in South Africa, and a lot of them are very, very irate. The fact that the land question was not even put on the table prior to Mandela's release. They weren't allowed to even talk about it. So I'm glad to see that more and more this question in terms of the land question is really resonating with a lot of African people. And I will say this about ANC in terms of their ability to organize. They're very, very organized from the bottom to the top. They're very, very organized. And they move as a unit. And that's, to be very appreciative. But I think that PAC is really making headway in South Africa in terms of, just critiquing the injustices and looking at the current system and understanding that simply changing the skin color of the oppressor, there's nothing in terms of addressing the needs and aspirations of African people. Now, one final thing I want to say about Africa is that, one of the things that when we talk about imperialism, people fail to appreciate the level of exploitation that goes on the continent. Now, even now, when you look at Africa just in terms of trade, now when Africa borrows money from the West, in many situations when the West imposes money on Africa for particular strategic reasons, when you look at the kind of money that are there, one of the stipulations is that when it comes to Africa, they pay the highest interest on any kind of money that they receive from the West. And now, despite these high interests on these payments, Africa has been very, very good in terms of actually paying these people on time. And so you would think that because Africa has been very, very good in terms of paying people back on time at an exorbitant interest rate, that you would think that they would treat Africa more kindly in terms of, the interest that it charges and that kind of thing. So the mere fact that they refuse to be after injustice speaks to not only just, it's not even a question of economics, because economics would say that if, in fact, you have a customer who pays on time a high interest rate, then that's certainly a customer that you don't want to lose. But that's the exact opposite in terms of what's going on in Africa in terms of the exploration is actually increasing. So therefore, it speaks to not only the economic oppression of Africa, but possibly speak to the social relationship in terms of Africa being the origin of all people, and that because it's the origin of all people, then by extrapolation, then you have to say that those who propagate racism, those who want you to believe that, in fact, they are the quote-unquote the superior race, it's in jeopardy. So I think that for social reasons, I think also that's a driving factor in terms of why the level of aggression, the exploitation of Africa continues unabated. So I think that AAPRP is definitely instrumental in terms of, helping Africa view that whole question in terms of imperialism, in terms of which way forward. And I think it has to be, I really think it has to be imposed without. I think a lot of people have a difficult time with the fact that, they feel that Africa should solve its own problems, where my position is that we're all Africans, so we all have an equal stake in terms of helping Africa, deal with its problems, and particularly as it relates to imperialism. So that's essentially my view in terms of Africa.
Okay, our last panelist for the night, we have with us Brother Bam Boshi Shango, who is also an organizer for the All African People Representative Party, GC. We'd like to welcome him, and we'd like to pose this question to our brother, Bam Boshi. As we talk about African Liberation Day, as it being an institution, how does he see it being used from a political point of view when it deals with the question of land and this question of power? How do the APRPGC view this institution of African Liberation Day when they talk about, or when we look at the land question and this question of power? Brother Bam Boshi.
Good evening, everybody. I'm really honored to be on this panel with people who are really just great in terms of the work they've done. I know Brother Paul Pumphrey, who's been out there working since the early 70s at least, when I think I first ran into him. I know that he's been through a number of organizations. He's been working with a number of struggles around the world, not just the Congo. He's been struggling in Haiti. He's been in the anti-apartheid movement here. He's been working in the unions. The same for Brother Alberto Jones, who I greatly respect the work that he has done. I mean, he's one of the people who I wish I could be like, because he has physically stood up to the Miami Mafia. Those Cubans in Miami who are so rabidly anti-Cuba and anti-Castro that they foam at the mouth at the mention of the name Fidel or Raul. I'm honored, Brother Alberto. Brother Aki, you know, we go back a long ways, and Anthony is my comrade and brother. So I'm really, really happy to be on this panel. I would say that sometime we have a math problem. We don't count right. We don't get history right. I think that the fact is that African Liberation Day is over 65 years old this year, that it was founded at the first conference, All African People's Conference, in Accra, Ghana, called by Nkrumah when Ghana became the first independent country on the continent south of the Sahara. I think that if we start at 65, then we can possibly say, yes, it has been organized inside the United States for over 52 years, that in 1972, the African Liberation Support Committee was formed, and on that committee was a number of people, including Cleve Sellers, who was the central committee person from the AAPRP, and Kwame Ture, chairperson and brother then, followed it completely and gave input through Cleve Sellers to the ALSC Coordinating Committee. For us, for the AAPRP, in 1976, we decided that African Liberation Day was not necessarily a Maoist organization. It was not a Marxist-Leninist foundation formation, but instead that it belonged to the people who were waging the struggle, the African people. And for that reason, in 1976, we felt that we had to take African Liberation Day back to Africa. And since 1976, for over 48 years, the APRP has been organizing ALD in almost every corner of the world. Today, ALD is an institution. And it's an institution like the schools, like the libraries, like things that last forever. And because it's an institution, it is not an institution owned by the AAPRP. And because of that, you can see today many different groups, many different formations organizing African Liberation Day. We have relationships with many of them. We worked with helping the Black United Front to start their first African Liberation Day, which was held in Chicago in 1992-93. We also have worked with many other organizations. Even for us, when we organized the first African Liberation Day, we organized it as the AAPRP alone in D.C., but we also organized it in coalition with other groups in New York, in with the December 12th coalition. We organized it with PACO, Pan-African Organizations, in Los Angeles. We organize it with a number of other organizations throughout Europe and England. So we have never felt that African Liberation Day was the sole property of the AAPRP. However, we felt that we need to maintain some kind of observation, some kind of influence on African Liberation Day so that it didn't get manipulated, it didn't get co-opted, it didn't get sidetracked. And we have been doing that. For us, African Liberation Day had three basic functions. One, to inform and update the audience that came to the programs about the struggles taking place of our people and of progressive and revolutionary peoples and their organizations and movements all over the world. So for many people in the United States, probably the first time they met PAC, first time they met MPLA, first time they met the PAIGC, or even the Palestinians, were at African Liberation Day, because we felt that we could not tell the struggle that the people in Palestine was waging, that while we could say something about it, the best people to tell that struggle would have been the Palestinians. So we developed a relationship with them. We brought them to African Liberation Day to do presentations, to give you updates on where their struggle were, what they needed, what kind of victories they've made, etc. Also, we felt that African Liberation Day should be used to build and strengthen the movement, to build and strengthen the AAPRP, to build and strengthen those other organizations that were organizing it. So here we have no problem. However, this year, we would see to emphasize that the fundamental problem we have today is not direct colonialism. As a matter of fact, because it's not direct colonialism, many people think colonialism is over, that our oppression is over, that the last state in Africa has been independent. What are we fighting for? But today we see clearly neocolonialism everywhere, even inside the United States. We call your attention to Barack Obama. So for us, we felt that neocolonialism was one of the issues, one of the roadblocks that was holding us back from true independence, and that inside of the neocolonial camp, there were intellectuals whose role it was to use their intellectual abilities to argue, to dissuade people from liberation, to dissuade them from fighting against capitalism, to dissuade them from fighting against imperialism. Those people the neocolonial intellectuals, are a serious threat to us today because they are on the offensive. And you can see it. I mean, why was it necessary to have Malcolm X a life of reinvention? Why? Why do we need to reinvent Malcolm X? There's only one purpose, and you can see it, to create confusion, to dismantle the effect that Malcolm X has had on the movement historically, to say he was confused and that what he did had no substance and no bearing. But that's not true. We see today a book on Kwame Ture that we're still trying to find out where this book and where's the author coming from and going with it. We have some ideas. But we're saying that these neocolonial intellectuals are a serious problem to our movement. And unless we begin to identify them, and it's not just two, there are millions of them. They've taken over the black studies programs in universities all over this country. They have attempted to use their books and the foundations and foundations' money that financed them to write these books to reinvent our struggle, to reinvent our history, and we have to stop them. And I'll stop right there. I'm sorry.
That's an excellent lead-in to this general question, and I'd like to raise this question with my other panelists. I see, as you stated earlier, Brother Bamboche, that the AAPIPGC had decided to take on for this year, African Liberation Day, Smash Neocolonial Intelligentsia, the true face of the counter-revolution. You see this, your organization see this as the major problem today. I'm just curious in terms of if we talk about unity among our people, we must have this concept of unity of thought. How do the other panelists see the fundamental issue or issues that are facing our people? How do they see this? How do you dissect today's problem, fundamental problems among the African people today, Brother Paul? Or Brother Alberto? Brother Alberto, Brother Paul, in terms
yes.
of from your experiences, how do y'all dissect the fundamental problem among African people today as it relates to this issue of disunity? We have just heard the position of APRPGC. I'd like to hear the position from maybe your organization or you as an organizer in terms of some kind of feedback from your experiences. When you look at our people problems, what is more fundamental? What are the fundamental issues that you see that's keeping our people from unity? And that's for Brother Paul, Alberto, and Brother Haki. But we start with Brother Paul. Go ahead.
I would start off by saying that part of it is a well-organized confusion. You have a serious campaign of miseducation that has been given in our community. I mean, for one good example was the example of people trying to use the fact that President Obama was elected to the office of president as if to say that that meant that black people were free, that black people really didn't have anything to have to struggle for anymore. That kind of confusion really was hard to beat back because you had all kinds of puppets of imperialism promoting such craziness to the people in this country. And, of course, the media gave them plenty of airtime. In fact, nowadays you actually have some of them who have their regular news hour on the network, where they apologizing and trying to justify some of the most vicious imperialist acts done by the United States as being okay. When they were attacking, for example, Libya, and they tried to make it look like it was okay that the United States played the role it played. And it created a lot of confusion because they certainly had a much bigger bullhorn to push out their propaganda than we did in countering and trying to lay out the truth. There were many attempts of trying to help people to understand the contradictions that were being lied about on this whole struggle that was going on inside of Libya. And, of course, after they made it look like Libya had actually gotten itself liberated with the killing of President Gaddafi, then their own representatives is killed by the so-called good guys inside of Libya, ended up killing the U.S. ambassador and three other of his assistants. But I think it's clear that, and I agree with the point the brother Bambuzzi brought up, that we really have to begin to make things clear, because I'll give you an example. When we talk about how Africa is robbed, rarely do we talk about such things as when you see gold being sold out of Africa around $40-some thousand a kilo, but yet not recognizing that when Europe or the United States or Asia refine that kilo of gold, it's resold at a value of over $280,000 a kilo. That is, we used to call it when we were young, we used to call that highway robbery. How can you tell folks that all you want to pay them for their gold is $40,000 when all you put a little effort in melting it down and shaping it and mixing it with some other alloys, you're going to turn around and sell it for seven times the value? I mean, the same thing happens with iron, the same thing happens with copper, the same thing happens with diamonds, the same thing happens with all of these valuable minerals that are found in the continent today. And people are not connecting the dots and understanding that often the wealth that gets amassed in North America, in Europe, even in parts of Asia, comes from the robbing through neocolonialism, the robbing of the continent of Africa. And we have to recognize it, and we have to say no to it. And we have to recognize that we have to build an educational campaign so that our community understands this contradiction, and also create a solidarity act in how we give support to our brothers and sisters in the continent that is also fighting against the neocolonial powers that are robbing the continent on a regular basis. But we also should take advantage in looking at ways of how we can bring some of that technology to the continent, because there's no real reason why gold cannot be refined in Africa, why diamonds cannot be cut in Africa. Obviously, Europe and the United States are vested in not selling that technology to Africans. But because we happen to be here, and because many of us have U.S. passports, it is illegal for them to refuse to sell us that technology. And nothing is stopping us from taking that technology to the continent. And in fact, allowing our brothers and sisters as they work to rebuild their economies, to rebuild their countries, to take advantage of refining their resources in the continent and telling the market that if you want cocoa, you got to buy the chocolate out of West Africa, not the cocoa anymore. They're no longer going to be selling cocoa beans. They're going to sell chocolate. And it has to be sold at the, and you have to buy it at the value of chocolate, not at the value, the way below value that you're selling the cocoa beans. Same thing for shea butter. Same thing for the different minerals, such as gold, or precious stones, such as diamonds, or such things as copper or iron or oil. It is amazing to look at countries such as Nigeria for the amount of crude oil it sells every day, and yet it has to buy back refined oil at 7 times the value of the crude oil they sold out. And then people wonder, why are African people on the continent living so poorly? It's because the cards are stacked against them. And we need to look at the role that we can play and help them to reverse that process and to empower our brothers and sisters to be able to develop their countries as they should be able to develop them. And clearly I'm not suggesting that the way of developing their countries is to use fossil fuel, or the way to develop their country is to take on the economic policies and practices of their former colonial powers and the neocolonial powers that exist today. That clearly Africa must take a different direction. It must look at other examples, such examples that have been set by countries such as Venezuela and Cuba, for example, in looking at ways of how they've solved their problems around education, how they've solved their problems and now solving their problems around housing and affordable housing, and how they're solving their problems around the issue of health care as ways of looking at an alternative to that that's been imposed on them so many years by the neocolonial powers. And at that point, I'll stop talking and let my other brothers speak.
Okay, Brother Alberto, you're very unique in terms of being an African who was born in Cuba and having a chance to live inside the United States and travel throughout the Caribbean. From your perspective, Alberto, and from your experiences, how do you view or what do you see as being the major fundamental problem of keeping our people from unifying?
I think the problem have been laid out extremely clear by other speakers. Bambush could not have made it clearer and better for all of us to understand. The solution ought to be in us massively educating our people. Through education, the prejudice, the miseducation, the misinformation, the division, and all of these factors that are applied against our people today can be severely minimized. And fortunately, that's where I think Cuba has an important responsibility to fulfill. If we can join forces, I am ready and willing, and that I've been trying to do, not very successfully for many years, to channel as many of our children to the educational system over there. We try to support the cost of their education in whichever way we can. And when those students graduate, they are far less likely to buy into all of these gimmicks with which our people are divided. We are packaged, repackaged, and sold false leaders. We don't know exactly where we are going. So if there's anyone who can think of ways how they can support our work, I am open, willing to work with everybody, because my only goal is to get as many people in every field of knowledge so that we can begin to fight back. Thank you.
Brother Alberto, I know that you have a limited amount of time in terms of being able to participate on this program, but can you let our listening audience know how they can get in touch with your organization and how they can help support your organization work?
Okay. The best way to reach the Caribbean American Children Foundation is either writing to P.O. Box 353593, Palm Coast, Florida. Zip code is 32135. Or my email is C as in Charles, A as in Apple, C as in Charles, F as in Frank, followed by number 2 at AOL.com. Once again, CACF2 at AOL.com.
Okay, we thank you, and we'd like to move to Brother Haki, and we'd like to raise this issue with Brother Haki. In terms of today, when we look at our African youth, we can see the confusion among our African youth, African people in general throughout. But one of the confusion that we can see is that there seems to be a tendency of our people going backwards in terms of not no longer being proud to want to say they are African or have some kind of connection with Africa. What do you see in terms of what needs to be done to change that demeanor among our people?
Yes, strange enough. I went to Megan Ever House in Mississippi and had an opportunity to talk to a sister who grew up with Mega Evers, and she talked about his assassination. And she talked about how the fact that when Mega Evers would talk to the people in terms of importance of standing up, resisting injustice, actively fighting against injustice. She talked about the resentment among many in the African community in terms of being in opposition to what Mega Evers were talking about. Of course, the vision was that, if we follow your lead, we may lose our jobs, so there was a disincentive in terms of listening to what Mega Evers had to say. And so the question I posed to her, I'm saying, I hear that. That's the class question. I hear that. I said, but, one of the things is that reality is that what did people have to lose? You had rapid poverty, rapid unemployment. What, in fact, did they have to lose? And, I often think about when I listen to Peter Tosh, the late Reagan's hand, he talked about everybody wants to get to heaven, but nobody wants to die. So it seems to me odd that those particular African community who sang the praises, of the church, among those who are most resistant in terms of standing up and fighting against injustice. So I think to some extent, just in order for that to happen, in order for people to be resistant to standing up for their own self-interest, I think either one or two things have to happen. You have to believe that this is without doubt the best system in the world, or you would have to believe that intellectually you're just incapable in terms of changing the system that you're confronted with. It's one of those things that I've been thinking about a lot in terms of this why this propensity from among so many of our people to see the blatant injustices inflicted. When you look at the incarceration, large incarceration of African males, in this society, when you look at the unemployment numbers, when you look at the general despair that exists in terms of African community, one would think that that it would enrage. But the mere fact that it doesn't enrage suspect that one, maybe you are feeling powerless, and certainly that's understandable when you come up against insurmountable odds that you would feel powerless. But it also, at some level, it should generate some type of anger. It should. So the mere fact that no anger has been generated among so many of our people, in my mind, leaves me with great concerns in terms of precisely what is the real mechanism behind, you know, this resistance in terms of, you know, at least articulating, you know, your anger, your dissatisfaction with the way things are. I mean, clearly there are those in the community who think the fact that this is the best possible of all worlds. I mean, there are a lot of our people who are very ignorant of that history, who believe that, in fact, that we were lucky to be rescued from Africa and brought here. I mean, clearly, they exist. And the question is, how do you get these people to talk about these kind of things? That is the more difficult question, is to actually engage people around, you know, the most intimate personal thoughts. That's a very, very difficult endeavor. I think the only thing we can do in terms of, trying to get people to address these issues is the only thing you really can do is just continue, you know, just continue over and over again, you know, articulate, you know, just, you know, not only the blatant injustices, but in terms of the impact, not only immediate impact, but long-term impact on our African community. It's probably all you can do in terms of impact on that process. But there are really things that we can do, and which is more a long-term strategy, and you know, it's one of the things that people through the ages have been advocating, and for whatever reason, it hasn't quite resonated with the African middle class. And that is that since we understand that the function of self-esteem is very, very important in terms of fortifying one, you know, to stand up against injustice, you know, to understand that justice simply doesn't exist, that you have to actively fight against it. But in order to do that, you need a certain amount of self-esteem in terms of doing that. And one of the things that stirred a lot of people understood was that given our historical experiences in this country, that a lot of the self-esteem was seriously lacking. And so, therefore, we have to do something that's going to, in fact, enhance or reinvigorate one's self-esteem. So the thing is, I think we have to do, I think, you know, the role of institutions. Now, the closest thing we have in terms of institutions is the church. Now, it would be ideal if we could get the churches, you know, to organize around, you know, the needs of the people and actually, you know, preach to the people in a way in which serves to enlighten, serves to make people aware in terms of exactly what's going on and their responsibility in terms of fighting the kind of injustice that exists. To demonstrate that fighting against injustice is what the Creator intended. And so as a Christian, you're obligated to do such that. And, of course, a lot of people reason, well, that's a pipe dream. And I'm inclined to believe that most preachers are not particularly enthused about liberation theology. Most of them are not. Most of them, to a large extent, also have been conditioned to believe, in fact, that materialism, you know, is the name of the game. And so when you hear preachers stand up and they talk about the fact that Jesus wanted me to be prosperous, Jesus wanted me to be productive, you know, and all this thing, and Jesus wanted me to look good, I think it's just a thin veil, you know, attempt to disguise in fact that, you know, you're simply about the materialism and not about what Jesus professed to be about. So I think the role in terms of institutions, I think we need in terms of, you know, just trying to get our people where they need to be. And it starts as kids and not when they become teens, but as children. I think one of the things that Craig Hodges talked about when he played with the Bulls, and he talked about and he told that dumbass Michael Jordan, he said, listen, man, we use our resources to create institutions throughout the city because they're so important. Because if we don't create institutions, the kids are going to kill each other. Of course, Michael Jordan didn't understand what he was saying, and needless to say, the clown went to the owners of the Bulls and they blacklisted Craig Hodges. In other words, we can't have an intelligent athlete making this kind of money. You actually might use the money to actually empower the African community, and we simply can't have that. But institutions, I think, is the key. I think that is the key. I mean, that is the key to have institutions where we make sure that when two things happen in institutions, that first, that the kids are introduced to African history, and which they understand clearly in terms of all human beings, the African's contributions to the world, and check, you know, Africa's place in world affairs. And the kids have to be 4 to 5 with that kind of knowledge, kind of understanding. I think also the whole circle around reading and maybe playing a musical instrument and just in terms of enhancing their cognitive abilities, you know, in terms of being able, you know, to be more analytical, to be able to contrast. Those are the kind of things that people need in terms of we're going to fight this imperial system. Because one thing we're very, very clear on, that these people are very crafty and they're very analytical, and they do study in terms of, you know, how they actually care about this, care about their oppression of African people. And so we have to be equally astute in terms of our critical analysis, in terms of being able to see this thing for what it is. But I think it has to start at an early age. I think by the time, you know, as people get older, it becomes more and more difficult. It's not impossible. It just becomes more and more difficult, you know, to shake the kind of social conditioning which suggests that, you know, that your intellect or your worth is based upon one or two things, either wealth or the color of your skin. But once people internalize such values, then as they get aged, it's very, very difficult to get them to disavow such views. And so, therefore, I think it's important as we those institutions that particularly start with the children in terms of making damn sure that the kids understand clearly who they are and their contributions to the world. And I think once the kids grow up with that understanding and learn, but that's only part of it, but then we have to kind of create the conditions in the community that says that all the things that they're learning in these institutions are true. So it's a lot of work, but it calls for people understanding that there's a problem in the first place. Most middle-class Africans are unwilling to even acknowledge it's a problem. They're more willing to intimate that the problem is not the system, it's black people. And it's a theme that I hear over and over and over again. And so, and one of the things that amazes me is that it seems to me that if you say, you see all the injustice happening, but still you side with the oppressor, then what does that say about you? To internalize the oppressor's value system, in order to do that, then you have to, on some level, you have to negate yourself. You got to say, you got to say that I have no worth in the world in order to do that. Because, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, when we're confronted with injustice, when we see injustice, that it should make you feel as though, if nothing more, it should be an irritant. But when it's not an irritant, when people actually embrace the values which are exploitive, manipulative, you know, downright sociopathic, and you want to be just like them, it speaks volumes in terms of, you know, how you see yourself. And this is the bigger problem. This is why I think that we have to have institutions in terms of bringing real change to our people to make sure that we're on the road to doing what we have to do, because the challenges ahead of us are very extremely complex. These people, the system is in disarray, and many people don't even realize in terms of the BRIC nations, when we talk about Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, they're actually organizing, using their wealth in terms of buying a lot of Western financial institutions. Their attempt to shape, you know, world politics and to change the paradigm that people find themselves confronted with. Now, clearly, the intelligence community and the business community, that's not going to like that. In fact, they met last week to discuss this, what they perceive as a crisis in terms of what's going on with the BRIC nations in terms of their attempt to actually change the paradigm in terms of what goes on in the world. Now, in order for them to challenge what's going on in the world, in order for the U.S. to challenge the BRIC nations, it's going to mean more resources, not less resources. As they take the resources out of the country, you know, for strategic reasons in terms of trying to undermine BRIC nations, what does that mean for the masses of people, particularly the masses of African people in America? What are you going to do? You think food is expensive now? You think housing is too high now? You think that mass incarceration is atrocious? If you think that is the problem now, then what do you think is going to happen in the future? So we're working for the context of a ruthless system, and we have to understand what it is. But we can't really get that system if, in fact, we see that system part and parcel of our own. So our job, to the extent that's possible, is to make sure that people understand clearly that this system is not your own, and not only is it destructive to you as a human being, but it's destructive also to future generations of people who look just like you. So that is a struggle for us, and I think the only way we can achieve that is realistically, I think, is we have to think in terms of institutions. Now, I know there are people who say, well, that's a mother and father's job. That's their responsibility to educate their children. Yes, you're absolutely correct. That is right. But, you know, the problem is that if mother and father doesn't have the information to give to their child, they can't. And this is the fundamental problem that we're confronted with. You got a lot of parents who are well-intended, you know, want their kids to be educated, want their kids, you know, to exceed, you know, like school and so forth and so on. Not necessarily understand that the kind of things you need, the kind of tools you need in terms of empowering that child to compete in the system, the parents themselves are lacking. So this is the dilemma that we're confronted with. So we have to have institutions if we really want to change that whole paradigm that exists in the African community.
Okay. I'd like to address this question to Brother Anthony and our All African People's Revolutionary Body, GC. But before I address the question to our Brother Anthony, we would like to let our listening audience know that at this time, if you have any questions or comments on the subject concerning the history and the institution of African Liberation Day, as well as this whole question of African unity, or what has been said so far by our panelists, feel free to call in at 323-679-0841. That's 323-679-0841, and make sure you punch 1 so we can acknowledge the last 4 digits of your phone number. Right now, Brother Anthony, one of the things I think would be real crucial for our listening audience, we'd like to know a little bit about, what is the history of the All African People Revolutionary Party, GC? And if you can give us something about, talk a little bit more particularly about what is the necessity for this concept that we call Pan-Africanism and this economic system that we call socialism that so many people know very little but hate so much. Can you just speak to in general how is the party planning on organizing billions of Africans around the world for the attainment of Pan-Africanism in general? How did the party see how to go about doing that?
Okay. I'd be glad to address that, Brother Africa. And I just wanted to follow up to what Brother Haki was saying in terms of, you know, education. I think it's important that people understand that neocolonialist intelligentsia are developed as a result of, you know, of capitalism educating our youth, and not providing resistance to that. The purpose of any educational system in society is to perpetuate the ideas of the ruling class of that society. So what happens as a result of the educational system and the media is that you produce the people that perpetuate the ideas of the dominant ruling class of capitalist societies. And a lot of African countries, tend to send their youth to these imperialist countries to get educated. And that contributes to where a lot of the neocolonialist intelligence comes from. In terms of the role of the All African People's Revolutionary Party, we see our role today as the political education organization for people to achieve Pan-Africanism, the total liberation and unification of Africa under scientific socialism. And the reason why people are so scared of this term or opposed to it is because of the capitalist media, for the most part. Primarily to the capitalist media. Which is why I have, people hating something that they can't even define. And we see our role as developing a cadre or the leadership that could actually develop among our people these ideas to counter the capitalist ideas that are being pumped by the imperialist forces worldwide, and we need mass education. The reason why the contradictions that Haki alluded to, we're seeing so much of, is because most of the intelligentsia is in the service of the ruling bourgeoisie of these capitalist societies. They're in service of them. They do not feel obligated to serve the people whose labor made their education possible. And so you have a situation in which the neocolonialist intelligentsia works against the interests of the masses of African people, even though that's that's where they come from. And we have to counter this by revolutionary organization and developing the revolutionary intelligentsia to counter what's happening to our people now.
Okay, we'd like to again let our audience know that our phone line is open by calling in at 323-679-0841. 323-679-0841. We have a caller. We have caller 2525. Caller 2525, welcome to Africa.
Yes, sir.
Your question or comment, please.
All right. Well, I don't necessarily have a question, but I want to commend Brother Haki for his growth and development through the years. My mentor, Bamboshi, for your consistency, and the other guests for being consistent and, you know, making this a priority. And I've just enjoyed the show, and I wish us well in changing this current paradigm that the world is suffering under, and let's get free.
All right, caller, we thank you for your contribution.
Yes, sir.
All right, let's continue to move forward. Brother Bamboshi, when we look at this question of, we hear this word all the time, this question of imperialism. You hear this question of being anti-capitalist. What is the historical basis of why African people should be dialectically opposed to a capitalist system, an imperialist system? And can you talk a little bit about the movements that are going on now that reflect that from African people and other oppressed communities? Because I know there's in the news, there's some confusion about what's going on in Venezuela and Cuba. There are some confusions on what's going on in Africa, whether in Zimbabwe or Southern Africa, what have you. From your own analysis, can you speak to the people just in general and try to break it on language there? When you say you're against capitalism and anti-imperialism, can you really talk about why and talk a little bit about some of the people movements that's going on that we need to be aware about? Because this is one of the things I know for the many years that have been the African Liberation Day that you'll get to hear and see. You'll begin to get to see a global perspective and see how the various movements and struggles fit together. Brother Bamboshi.
Yes, sir. I think that most of your guests tonight have mentioned that the problems in terms of the people in the United States is confusion. And my brother Kwame Ture always said that confusion was the enemy of the revolution. Now, he said that for most of the people who are against socialism, if you ask them, could they tell you what socialism is? They couldn't give you a definition, even an incorrect definition. And that it would seem that if you take a system and say this system is your enemy, for example, socialism, then you would want to know your enemy. You would want to know everything about your enemy so you know how to properly fight it. But it's just the reverse here. You have an enemy, so you don't want to know anything about him. That's absurd. But there is a cause to this absurdity. The cause is that the system that you live under, capitalism, don't want you to know anything about socialism. And that's the essence, the reality that we're living under. Now, capitalism, again, is a system where the rich get rich and the poor get poorer. It's a system where quality and quantity goes down, prices go up. I remember as a youth coming up, as a teenager, I could take 25 cents and go to the grocery store, get a great big bag of potato chips. Today you take $5, go to the grocery store, and you get a little small bag of potato chips. Quality and quantity goes down, prices go up. But even more insidious is the fact that this wealth, the money that people make off of potato chips, etc., is being concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer people. So in other words, you have a small number of people who own and control the resources of the world. And then you have the majority of us. You have the 99% who works for sometime, but sometime not, this 1% who owns and controls everything. And the amount of money that this 1% have is so vast that it is unimaginable to us. We can't imagine it. It is so vast that we delude ourselves into thinking that people who consider themselves middle class, people who still work for a living, doctors, etc., are rich. If you're working for a living, you're not rich. You might be middle class, higher middle class or lower middle class, at best. The amount of money that rich people have, we cannot fathom today. And so because of that, because of this mysterious mystique that they build around themselves, we think that they're unconquerable, that they're just there. They're like gods. But folks who believe that socialism is the correct way for people to go are usually here to say, no, those gods have to fall. That Evo Morales, the first indigenous president of Bolivia, who is, like most indigenous people, a lover of Mother Earth, a respecter of Mother Earth, says very clearly that for Mother Earth to survive, for our environment to survive, and you know we can't survive without Mother Earth, for Mother Earth to survive, capitalism must be destroyed. It's clear. Now, when you look at countries that they tell you are socialists and look at what these countries are doing, what these countries have done, you can see clearly the difference. And you can also see why a capitalist country would not normally just evolve into a socialist country. But capitalism has to be destroyed. In countries that are socialists, the people are probably healthier because they have free health care. The people are more educated They have free education. The people are striving to house themselves to ensure that there's no homeless people laying on the street because they can't afford a house. These are human rights. These are rights that people have just by the fact that they're people, not by the fact that they're rich. It's not rich people rights. These are human rights. And therefore, when you examine, and I encourage everybody to examine socialist societies, you begin to see a different relationship in those societies between resources and the people. Again, under capitalism, 1% or less owns and controls 99% of the resources. Under socialism, the resources are owned by the people. It's the people's resources. It's the people's schools. It's the people's government. Therefore, if you're living in a socialist society, you could truly say what Bundy, the racist farmer, said, that this is his land. Under socialism, it is your land. In Venezuela, for example, land has been redistributed. But not only has the land been redistributed, because if you just redistribute land, but don't give people the tools and equipment necessary to utilize that land, all they can do is really sell it back to the original owners in 1 or 2 years. So under socialism of a new kind in Venezuela, the people get redistributed land, but they also get tractors, farm animals, etc., to allow them to use and develop this land. They don't just say, here's some land, now go for yourself. It's more about people. And because of that, under socialism, people becomes the values of those societies. People becomes the capital of those societies, the human capital versus paper in this country, because it's not even backed by gold anymore. Paper in this country is a capital. It's what you base wealth on. On the socialist societies, wealth is based on the people. So I strongly encourage everybody to look deeply at socialism. I think Brother Paul said we have to look at alternatives, because alternatives to this system is probably the only thing that will save us. If we try to continue the way we're going, if we try to continue with polluting the earth at the level we're polluting it, we will not exist. That is clear.
Brother Paul, in terms of your work in the Congo, can you give our people a general update on what's going on in the area, and who are some of the players who are continuing to exploit, kill, and brutalize the African people? And talk a little bit about these political parties in the United States, the role that they are playing, the Democrat and the Republican Party. Are you with me, Brother Paul?
Well, are you sure he's not muted?
No, he's not muted. Okay. We'll come back to Brother Paul, and we'll go to Brother Alberto. Brother Alberto, I would like for you, if you could, speak a little bit about some of the realities of what life is like in a socialist country, such as like in Cuba. I think one of the things they have often talked about in this society, when they look at other alternatives, they try to tell the people that if you go for socialism, you'll be creating a society where there are no democracy, where people cannot be independent to think, where people cannot produce in a manner that would be affordable to take care of themselves. But from your experiences in terms of being able to be born in Cuba and looking at it today, what have you seen? What are some of the positive things that you can share with the audience? What is life like in Cuba, particularly, you know, from the Afro-Cuban perspective? That's the community in which you came from. What would you say to the people?
Well, there's a lot of scare tactics. Trying to have people be afraid of what socialism is without explaining what it's all about. When this question is posed to me about what the revolution, socialism, have meant for people of African descent in Cuba, I summarize it in the following way. We have made advances in 50 years that are far greater than anything we achieved in the 500 years before that. So significant it is, had it not been for revolution, none of us would have had access to higher education. We would not have the core of educated black people in every field in Cuba. But it's not only black people, it's everyone. The peace of mind with which people live, knowing that your health care, your retirement, your safety, your culture, your sports, all of these things is an integral part of your well-being. And not as we can see it. I just came back from New York. Beautiful theaters, fantastic place, but it's just for a handful of people. Who can afford to pay $200 maybe to go to a cultural event in New York? So that's a way of keeping our people down. We are ignorant, for a lack of a better word. So therefore, we are fed all of these type of simplistic entertaining, and we are kept assuming that that's the world, the phone, the games, and even worse, the pornography and all of those other degrading things. Regardless of many failures and mistakes that, like any government in the world, have taken place in Cuba, nothing more important for the well-being of the Cuban people has happened there since the arrival of Columbus to our shores. And I'm sorry to say, unfortunately, I have to leave the program, and I want to thank all of the participants for the tremendous contribution, and hope this leads us into greater success, and hopefully I am able to help some more of our brothers and sisters to achieve the education they need to be able to keep up or put up the real fight that we need to emancipate our people. Thank you and good night.
I mean, thank you, Brother Alberto. And continue to move forward, I will bring in Brother Haki, and I'd like to ask Brother Haki, could he give his assessment or his articulation on this particular question? Given all of these ills we have in the society and throughout the world, for example, when you talk about racism, when you talk about police brutality, when you talk about sexual exploitation, can no problems be resolved under a capitalist system, Haki? What is your take on that?
No, I think you're right, Brother Africa. I think those problems can't be resolved by a capitalist system. In fact, a capitalist system exacerbates those problems. In fact, they need those problems in terms of just in terms of existing. The more they can vilify people, the more they can create conditions to make people act in ways that are inappropriate, the put it off on them. It just it gives them a justification to lock up, you know, literally millions of people in a society. So we're going to be very clear on that. Now, it's a real question in terms of, I think, let me just address this question in terms of socialism. Now, one of the things that most Americans don't understand, because as your previous panelists alluded to, is the fact that there's a lot of confusion when it comes to, socialism. Now, just in terms of the most recent example, concrete example in terms of socialism, was back in 2008, when they had the whole housing debacle, you know. Now, what they did in order to save this government, in order to save the global economy, in order to save this economy, the U.S. economy, they took money from us, from the citizens, and gave trillions of dollars to corporations and to banks. Now, clearly, if they wouldn't have did that, the society would have failed. The global capitalism would have failed. It would, at that point, it would have self-destructed. So by giving them this large infusion of cash, they were able to get things done that they perceived as important. The problem is that when it comes to poor people in society, when it comes to large infusions of money to poor people in society, it's decried as socialism. Socialism is a good thing. Socialism allows people to develop to do their highest capacity, to be the highest form of humanity. That is what we need. Capitalism foments destruction. It pits one person against another. It creates a human war between men and women. It creates an unjust system where, you know, in terms of your labor, it doesn't matter how much you produce, the kind of earnings, your wages, continue to fall. So this very corrupt and evil system of capitalism is, in fact, the epitome of what's hurting the world today. And there's no way of getting around it. Now, just in terms of socialism as it relates to rich people, stop and think about it. When you talk about interest rates, I mean, what are you really saying? What are you even saying? All you're cleverly doing is transferring wealth from one group to another. In this case, in America, you're transferring wealth to working people to the wealthy. That's all interest rate. That's all it does. Inflation. What is inflation? It's an invisible tax. Again, who benefits from inflation? Certainly not the working people. Certainly not the poor people. The people who benefit from inflation are corporations and the Federal Reserve. Socialism. You're transferring wealth from one sector to another. Now, what's wrong with transferring wealth, you know, from the very damn wealthy to the poor? Wouldn't that make more sense in terms of more equitable, more harmonious society? You need socialism. But people are miseducated in terms of what socialism is all about. And Bush is right. Anytime you talk about socialism, inevitably people, you know, when you say that people frown, they perceive it as a bad thing. They don't even understand what socialism means. But they're being educated to perceive socialism as a bad thing. We need more socialism. It's the only thing that's going to save humanity. It's the only thing that's going to save this planet. Now, just in terms of capitalism, we talk about how efficient capitalism is. In fact, capitalism isn't efficient at all. Now, when you look at the healthcare system, if in fact you had a single payer system or socialism in which the government pays for everybody's healthcare, this country would save tens of billions of dollars. As opposed to a current capitalist system in which not only does it bankrupt, you know, millions and millions of people every year in this country, but it's also very inefficient in the sense that it does nothing in terms of addressing the needs of so many people in the society who need health care. Isn't it ironic that you got a social system which could give health care to everybody and save the government tens of billions of dollars a year versus one that costs the government tens of billions of dollars and does nothing in terms of addressing the needs of millions of its own citizens? Socialism is a good thing. In fact, when you talk about socialism, when you talk about the index in terms of the happiest people in the world, is always Scandinavian nations. Why are Scandinavian nations the most happiest people in the world? There's a reason why. They all live under socialist systems. People are not pitted against one another. People's needs are provided for. It's done in an equitable way. It can be done in a way in which their needs provided for the same token, making sure that the economy thrives. So what's wrong with that? Who doesn't want to live in a society in which, you know, you can live as a human being, you can walk the street at night and not have to lock your doors, not be afraid all the time, not walking around with guns? This is what socialism is all about. It's all about creating conditions to make damn sure, institutions to make damn sure that people understand their humanity. They live under a humane system which fosters humane values for the sole purpose of making sure that humanity thrives. Isn't that what human beings want? Is that what most human beings want? This capitalism thing is a very unique creature. It's a very unique creature. In a system that thrives on the ability to manipulate, to exploit, to use, cannot call it system humane. So any Republican or Democrat who stands up and say this is the most humane system on the planet is telling a damn lie. Socialism is what our people need. With socialism, we don't have to worry about school funding. We don't have to worry about property taxes paying to subsidize the schools, because the government does that. The people's money subsidizes the school. So everybody have equal education. So the same technology you have in one school, you have in another school. So there's no disparity in terms of, you know, access to education. But that's socialism. It's a question of whether you want to create a better human being, whether you prefer a society in which you're afraid of everything and everybody. And that's precisely what capitalism does. It creates a situation where you're afraid of everything and everybody. But I think socialism is inevitable. I think it's inevitable. And that's all I'm going to say about that.
Let's see if we can get our Brother Paul back. Brother Paul, are you still with us? Thank you, man, lost our Brother Paul. But in the process of looking at this whole history of the Institution of African Liberation Day, raised this with Brother Anthony. In terms of this year, for African Liberation Day 2014, when it comes to Washington, D.C., which will take place at the Festival Center, which is 1640 Columbia Road, Northwest Washington, D.C., for those who never been, can you talk about the climate? What are some of the type of activities people can expect to engage in for this year, African Liberation Day? And speak a little bit more about the theme. We didn't talk enough about that. I would like for you to talk a little bit more about the role of the neocolonial intelligentsia, more so in terms of how it is playing a role of preventing African people from being liberated and united. Brother Anthony, what can they expect for this year, African Liberation Day, in the band of the APRPGC?
Sure, Brother Africa. What they can expect is a better understanding of the role that the neocolonialist intelligentsia plays in our society, which is a role that their role is to perpetuate the ideas of the capitalist ruling class. And they do that through manipulating historical information, and they're trying to make money off of our history or off of our suffering, if you will. And they're because they hold back the people's progress by not telling the truth, basically. By manipulating information in such a way that it serves the interests of the capitalists instead of serving the interests of our people. And what we intend to do this year is have a symposium in which our people are presented with a decision that they have to make. The intelligentsia either has to serve the people, the interests of the mass of the people, or they serve the interests of that small sector of the bourgeoisie. And that's really what it comes down to. You either serve the interests of capitalism, or you help the people to achieve socialism. And that's what we're trying to do. And what we want to do is present an analysis of the role of the neocolonial intelligentsia and the role of the revolutionary intelligentsia in terms of advancing our people's struggle, and also to give updates on how other people confronted with similar problems are dealing with their problems. And that's why we form relationships with other revolutionary organizations. Because Africans are not the only ones that are confronted with the problem of neocolonialism. All people around the world are confronted with this problem. So one of the things we want to try to do is present our audience information on how people are going about dealing with this problem of neocolonialism around the world.
Brother Bambushi, since many people believe we are living in a post-racial society, and looking at the recent election of Barack Obama in this country, what impact, what effect has that particular election have had on the Pan-African movement?
Well, I don't know if it has had any impact on the Pan-African movement. I know that all over the world where African people are, in the African diaspora, there were millions of old ladies and young ladies who were madly in love with Baraka because he was a handsome young man, etc. But even our sisters here all over the world have came to see him for what he is, a neocolonial agent. And it is clear when you have a man who wins an election by saying he's going to close Guantanamo, the gulag of the U.S., the prison system, the torture system, the system that holds people, including little kids, without charges, through horrendous conditions, force-feeding them. He won the election saying he was going to close it. He hasn't done that. Not only has he not done that, he won the election saying he was going to change the immigration system and make it more equitable and make it less exploitative and make it less racist. He has not done that. Instead, he is putting more immigrants in jail than any other president before him. Today, he kills at will. He has a secret kill list, and he takes it on himself to decide to be the judge, jury, and executioner of people in Pakistan, people in Yemen, people in Somalia, and now people in different parts of Africa, through AFRICOM, where they're drone bombing our brothers and sisters. Barack Obama takes full responsibility for doing drone bombs. Neocolonialism again. So I think it's becoming clearer and clearer to the people. However, I think that once, if folks come to African Liberation Day, or if they follow African Liberation Day, especially articles, etc., on our website at www.aaprp-gc.org. They will see these contradictions. It will become clearer and clearer that, you know, Obama is an employee of capitalism. Like most neocolonial agents, like most neocolonial intelligentsia, they're just employees, and many of them are low-level employees of capitalism, and many of them actually does this on a voluntary basis because they're not making enough money to really claim that they're making money off of being neocolonial agents. I would like to just add to what Anthony was saying about the schedule for African Liberation Day, because we have come to an agreement with the D.C. Metro Committee to Free the Cuban Five, who's hosting a reception for one of the Cuban Five who does artwork. And we're blending what would have been our reception into the reception for the D.C. Metro Committee to Free the Cuban Five. So after our panels, ALD continue, but it continues at the reception for the D.C. Metro Committee. As you know, five young men came to the United States to investigate terrorism that was based out of Miami. They gathered information on what these people were going to do, who they were going to kill, and they had killed many people, including an Italian tourist. And they brought this information and gave it to the FBI in the United States and told them, here is a group of terrorists living in Miami, planning on committing terrorism against an independent country. And the FBI and the State Department turned around and arrested these five young men. Two of them have been released, but three are still in jail, including one who they gave a double life sentence plus a couple of years. And so, therefore, as part of our solidarity work with the Cuban people, we're going to go to the reception of African Liberation Day.
Okay, and one of the points I think listener audience needs to know about the Cuban Five, if I believe correctly, understand correctly, three of the brothers played a major role in working side by side with our brothers and sisters in the liberation movement towards freeing countries such as Angola, Namibia, the Congo. Three of them volunteered to go and help struggle with our brothers and sisters. So not only are they biologically speaking a part of their family, but there's a historical and biological connection in terms of they're willing to donate and work with us, but put their lives in conjunction with us to make sure that all human beings are free. That's one of the things the African community need to know about the Cuban Five. They are men of principle. They are men who was willing and have put their lives for the interests of advancing Africa and humanity. So it becomes very important any time where you can support the Freedom Five movement in this country and throughout the world, you should do that, particularly if you are African, because we owe Cuba a lot. We owe Cuba a lot for the many contributions that they have made to Africa and African people. So we do encourage our brothers and sisters to learn all they can about the Cuban Five and support the Cuban Five. Okay, we're in the process of closing out. I'd like to ask my panelists today one fundamental question. We're talking about the importance of supporting African Liberation Day 2014 as an institution. Start with Brother Haki to our audience. Can you talk to our audience why it's important to support this institution?
Well, it's important to support African Liberation Day because it's in our best interest to do so, number one. They also have to, you know, the discussion that takes place on African Liberation Day helps to clarify, you know, exactly, you know, what the contradictions are in terms of, you know, why they're using the first place and their impact on our communities. So it's very important people, you know, who perhaps may have questions in terms of why these things are used as they did. It's good to hear, you know, the problems being articulated from, you know, so many perspectives. It's a very, very good thing. So I encourage people, you know, to come out to the ALD and, you know, to come, enjoy the festivities, but more importantly, to learn. So I encourage people to come out.
Okay. Do we have Brother Paul back with us? We're going to try one more time. Brother Paul, can you hear us? Okay, we're having technical difficult problems with Brother Paul in terms of closing out Brother Bamboshi. Why should they support AID this year? And how can they help build all African people up to the party, GC?
I would say ditto to what Brother Aki just said, that we encourage everybody to come out to African Liberation Day. We especially encourage you to come out to African Liberation Day being organized by the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC. However, we would be happy if you go to any African Liberation Day because we know that our people needs organization and that bad organization is better than no organization. So we encourage you again to come out to African Liberation Day this year, and we also would like to let you know that in 2016, it will be 50 years that the AAPRP has been organizing African Liberation Day. We hope to see you there.
And Brother Anthony, can you give our audience the logistical information on where African Liberation Day will take place and your final thoughts and comments on tonight's program?
Certainly. I would like to thank you again for inviting me and all the other brothers to participate in this program tonight. African Liberation Day, GC's commemoration of will take place at the Festival Center located at 1640 Columbia Road Northwest, Washington, D.C., near 16th Street Northwest and Columbia Road Northwest. And we encourage people to come to check out the presentations and also encourage your friends and family to come also and also check out visit our website, you know, for more information regarding the history of African Liberation Day and the history of the Pan-African Movement and the history of the All African People's Revolutionary Party, which is www.a-aprp-gc.org.
Okay, we'd like to thank our panelists tonight and our listening audience, friends and supporters for supporting Africa on the Move. As your host, Brother Africa, we'd like to remind you that without information, you cannot think, and without organization, you cannot think clearly. We'd like to encourage you to join an organization that is doing something to help liberate your people and humanity. Until next time, which will be Tuesday, May the 6th, from 10 to 12, we'll be back at the same time, same station. That will be May the 6th. Africa on the Move is a community project of the African Awareness Association. Until next time, let's continue to strive to go forward ever, backwards never, and support this year, African Liberation Day 2014. We thank you for coming to your homes tonight. Let's move forward to Africa.